You've got to get yourself loaded up with all kinds of esoteria.
So go ahead, I'm Mr. Coleman.
Are we?
Yeah, we're in.
Okay. Stop. Right? Jurgensen had 6 students all working on 1/3 size clay model. Now bear in mind that this is the beginning, really, of the period of applique in order to get identification on an automobile. So you're putting on chrome strips all over the place in different kinds of patterns in order to achieve a unique identification scheme. Mm-hmm. Well, it's pretty hodgepodge, and if anybody remembers, the 50s were noted, especially toward the tail end of that decade, for really lavish lay-ons of these applique patterns. They were just out of sight. It got to be a very tough period, bad meaning, of design, and earned automobile design a bad name for most industrial designers. Anyway, here are these 6 guys working on this 3/8 size clay model, one guy on each front corner, another 2 guys, one on each side in the middle, and then the rear 2 corners. And I could see that this thing was relatively incoherent, and so I grabbed my old friend George Jurgensen by the neck, and I said, for Christ's sake, why don't you teach him how to make it simple? And Jergy, as we called him, smiled nicely and said, you know, that's what we need, is a difference of opinion. Took me down to Adam's office, and in the essence, they got hired. So I was working part-time then, teaching at Art Center, and then part-time for Dreyfus. And the Dreyfus thing began to dwindle when the office became less important in the early 50s, and so I came over to Art Center as nobody was full-time, I should explain. What Adam's idea, of course, was to hire professionals to do the teaching so they'd know what was going on, be up to date, and not be too heavy as academics, that is, to really emphasize on the creative process a lot. There's a super point of view, and the philosophy remains. Well, that means that if you're not working for Dreyfus, which I did occasionally, time to time on a freelance basis, then you're doing other freelance work, which you must. And this is great fun, doing all kinds of different local products for plastic companies, and sometimes it's a rendering exercise, and then getting into which was the most exciting part, probably into journalism, if you could call it that is doing design stories, starting with Motor Trend, and then luckily making friends with John and Elaine Bond, who are the moving force behind Road and Track. And they invited me to do a series of stories, and I worked with John on a number of things where he engineered the chassis and I designed a shell body for it and that sort of thing. And as a matter of fact, one of those even got built once. So that evolution into Art Center was a very easy and pleasant one. It meant that I got to stay in California, which was a sort of an objective. And as the industrial design department developed at Art Center, to be able to be a part of it, John Coleman was probably one of the finest, I would never call him an instructor, I would call him a teacher in product design that I ever met. And I remember his telling me, this was way back and jumping around a little bit to when I was going to Art Center in 1935 and trying to do a still life drawing, which is Eddie Kaminsky, who was a brilliant designer, illustrator, photographer, running this basic course for these high school type kids. So he made a big setup of all different forms, painted white, and threw a single light source on it in order to emphasize direct light, core, cast shadow, and all that relationship. So you sit down and you draw this thing, and I'm coming out with a big gray mass because I felt you had to have value over everything, otherwise it would be nothing there. Wrong. Well, about 3/4 of the way through this thing, and Kaminsky says, get off the bench, give me that stick of charcoal. And he sat down and scribbled a big, strong core across the separation between direct and reflected light. And it just made the drawing jump off the page. And I was so fascinated. I ran to John and asked him, how did he know how to do that? And John, as I said, 125 pounds wringing wet, and I'm about 170, reaches up and says, for Christ's sake, you dumb kid, shakes me by the shoulders and says, well done. And then he goes through a scenario, where did I come from? And in the upshot, he's proving to me that in the environment, all this stuff exists in normal life, except you just don't see it. And why don't you carry a sketch pad and jot it down so that you know what happens in light, you know, and how it reacts to form? Well, that's what made John a great teacher. So he was probably one of the best influences we've had at Art Center, and understood automobile design in addition, because he'd worked in addition to being a great product designer.
Is he still in the factory?
No, he expired. He had a heart attack and... Well, he had a stroke, as a matter of fact, and was partly paralyzed. And well, it's a beautiful story, but it has no relationship to this. The fact that one of his students, who knowing that he had had a stroke and was incapacitated in a home being taken care of, and this man with this marvelous imagination, still very much alive, but with a speech impairment. So Fred would go and get a wheelchair and go out and see John and persuade him to get in the car and take him down to the farmer's market where we all had lunch. And so there'd be John, and he'd meet his old buddies and things like that. He was very humanistic. Well, John was like that himself. He had done something for Fred. Fred's ears stuck out like cab doors. John talked him into having an operation on his ears so he'd look better, so he'd have more confidence, so he'd be able to do better in his career. Little humanistic things like that. Yeah. That's, pardon the nostalgia, but that's what Art Center is between, I think, a good part of its permanent faculty, if you want to call them that, and the students, because there's a family relationship there that is exceedingly strong, and we keep track of each other, and our friends, and my best friends, have all been derived from people that have gone through the place, and they've gotten to know in the process. Mm-hmm. Ron Hill, our current department chairman, is, I think, a very good friend, and we're lucky to be able to get him back.
What's his background?
Ron grew up, I think, I knew he spent the latter part of his neophyte days here in Pasadena. I'm not sure whether he's born here or not. And his family, his mother and dad, still live here. Mm. So he went through Art Center, went back to General Motors, spent a 30-odd-year career there. And when we needed a new department head, he was the one guy that most of us agreed we'd like to have, and the hierarchy agreed and hired him. And General Motors was good enough to give him an early retirement so that he was able to make that transition after his, as I say, 30-some-odd years, and still maintain his retirement. Mm-hmm. And of course that augmented with a minor salary that you get at Arts Center as a department head. Mm-hmm. Makes it he's in good shape for his to put his kids through school.
You're obviously encouraged to take outside assignments.
Yes. Well, the Adams principle was that to hire operating professionals that mm-hmm. knew what was going on. In any design program, you have to be doing it to know what it is. You couldn't right. talk about it or instruct in it, certainly, without being a participant. Well, I think the proof of the pudding is the number of academicians, if I can say it, who are out there who will have a pat philosophy and stick to it over the years and be totally disoriented from their students. And the communication line is broken if you don't have some direct orientation to the activity. Okay. History of Art Center College of Design, which originally was conceived at the Art Center School. Edward A. Adams, A-D-A-M-S, had graduated from the Chicago Art Institute and gone to work in New York as an advertising designer, illustrator, and had some connection with copywriting. He was certainly deeply involved in the advertising business, and which has always been a hectic creative environment. He, as a good high-paced New Yorker would, got totally involved in the thing, and perhaps hazardous to his health, reached a point where he needed to recoup a little bit and came back to his home in Arizona from which he had originally generated. And in the process of relaxing and thinking it all over, actually he was ill and needed some time to recover, he thought about the gap that had occurred between his educational experience and what he had found in the industry that he approached, advertising, and thought that there needed to be something done about it. He was, in that sense, a natural educator and an empathic man where in human relations as well. Very creative type of man. He was famous in his day for illustrations that he did, among others, for the Ford Motor Company. In the days of the Model A, when there was a man named Williamson with whom they had contracted, that is through the advertising agency, to do their ads. And Williamson's was a very specific style. There was nothing foggy or nebulous about it. It was very definitive and very clean and represented the product in a very, very high plane. Williamson had come to this out of fashion illustration in which those specifics and sense of style were well blended. Mm-hmm. So his elements of background in addition to the product definition were superb. But there is a risky factor here that he should break a finger or fall down a flight of stairs or have anything happen to him, what would happen to the accounts? So naturally the agency would ensure that by having at least one or more backup artists. Well, it doesn't sound too great in a way, but it really was that Adams was selected to be one of those. And in that, he learned Williamson's techniques, of course, which were unique for anybody that does watercolor painting. This is done in very tight areas, and then you do a scrub process, which is taking that whole sheet of Wattman board on which the illustration has been composed with a very fairly strong colors, And you take a sponge and lightly go over it, and so some of the color is washed away and muted. And then you come back after it's dry and detail this and bring out certain areas. Now, this wash technique is unique, and it's what Williamson used, and he achieved terrific results with it.
What was the spelling of the type of blend that was used?
W-H-A-T-M-A-N, and it's made in England, and it has several different services. Let's see, hot press is one, and I think that's what Williamson used, and Adams as well. And that has a certain amount of texture to it so that you get a granular effect in the watercolor washes. Very handsome. Well, as I say, he came back to Arizona, thought about this, and resolved to do something about it and to form a school. So not having very much money, which is the famous preliminary for every great achievement story usually, he persuaded some friends that he knew, that he'd made along the way, professional artists, illustrators, designers, photographer, to join him in this enterprise, and they actually had more members of faculty than they did students at the very beginning. And in order to make their own payroll, they had to hawk their own cars every month, but they made it. The reason they had so many instructors is because he also visualized a process that would be more akin to the professional day, that is, in which one day a week is devoted to a class. And so you come in the morning and you do the whole day in this one frame. The next day would be another class. And so doing was able to simulate professional activity thoroughly. If you're developing an idea, you have a cup of coffee, talk it over with some friends. If you're in a normal school with a 1 or 2 hour period, that would be all over, and then you'd be off doing something else. So he realized that that was a way of simulating professional activity, using professionals to do the teaching in their own way, so that you're really directly orienting the student to a professional responsibility and opportunity. Great idea, and that's the way it still goes. It's a fundamental precept. His first wife was the recorder, the person that takes the new people around, that meets the possible entrants and so on. I was privileged to meet her, and as I say, in 1935. She eventually passed away, and then Mr. Adams married much later on a woman who had come to teach there, Virginia Lukakis, of a Greek origin. Most beautiful woman you ever saw. She was really gorgeous, this marvelous complexion, this beautiful jet black hair, dark eyes, and very perceptive. And it was one of the great romances of all time. It's hard to describe, but there's a lot more to it which will remain anonymous for their sake. But anyhow, and
you mean the spelling of the name?
Virginia Lukakis, L-E-G-A-K-E-S. She was, and still is, devoted to her husband's memory. She remains on the board of directors of Art Center many years after Mr. Adams' unfortunate death. He had a stroke and then eventually demised himself. Anyhow, he laid a pattern that was very important for educational purposes. The only detriment to that whole system is that the person that teaches on Monday sometimes doesn't get to talk to the guy that's teaching on Wednesday or Thursday or whatever other day, unless you have some sort of a special setup or meeting, which can be arranged, but that's the only fly in the ointment, which we're working on still. There are various ways of having meetings to orient that. The original faculty included Will Connell, who was a major photographer for the movie studios, and eventually broke away and formed his own school, but he set up the photo department, which became and still is perhaps the most popular, maybe one of the strongest departments in the college, although it's hard to put a precedence on that altogether.
K-O-T-T-L-E?
Will Connell is C-O-N-N-E-L-L. Stan Reckless, R-E-C-K-L-E-S-S, was the prime painting instructor along with, I'm trying to remember the name of the really important painting instructor who had a dominance, I guess I'll have to come back to that. What he did was hire the highest rate, that is the most effective, professionals in their field who also had a communicative ability. It isn't just being good in your field, because some of those are almost inarticulate at times, but these people had all of that. Reckless in himself was a marvelous, humane person. Many painters are. They have a great sense of humanity. I'm trying to remember all the names of the other things. I'd rather leave that to printed recorded history, because it's all there. The fact that John Coleman and George Jurgensen re-established the Industrial Design Department post-war in 1945, I think it's the most important move because they set up a curriculum at that time, which we somewhat adhere to today. There's the idea of course, 8 terms is what it is. Later on, we made it, well, it has always been 3 terms a year, so it's a trimester system. And that was emphasized for the sake of the Korean veterans when they came back, because here were people that had lost a couple of years in service and wanted to get into a professional career as quickly as they could. So to make up time, you accelerate the whole thing through. So if you really had to, you could do the 8 terms in 2 2/3 years, which is a good convenience for them, and it also ensured a continuous activity as far as the college is concerned. I guess I'll just stop. 8 terms means that you can divide it in half, really, with the first 4 terms being a foundation laid, and then the final 8 terms, or 4 terms, being the refinement process, or more specifically, the orientation to a particular major. Up until now, and we're just about to change this, we've allowed the students to define their direction. And in the industrial design department, we have always had product design as a little bit separate from transportation design, which really is a broad name for automobile design. In addition to that, some years ago, the local architects with large offices who do space planning for department stores and public buildings and even commercial buildings such as gas stations and so on, needed to hire designers to work in their large staffs and couldn't find anybody. The guys who were coming out of architectural college, for example, had higher ambition than work as a surface person. They needed people that could plan space, signage, hardware, display elements, and to do it in sufficiently original ways to enhance the merchandising spectrum. And they gave this various names, but it's wound up to be called, well, it became specialized structures at one point, and it's all sort of the same thing. And the people that did the teaching of this, of course, were the guys working in those large architectural offices as supervisors. So if they came in and do the teaching, they'd teach the students what they needed to know to enter that part of the profession. These would be guys that would be generally oriented toward architectural work, but have a high sense of graphics for the signage, for example, or in like product design, to be able to do display cases and that, all the hardware that goes with it. So it's a broad range of things. Well, now it's called environmental design because it encompasses, again, besides the public spaces, a broad sense of responsibility in design. If you're doing, you don't do a food mixer, you do a food preparation area, sometimes known as a kitchen. So it's that total awareness, and their graduates find jobs in all kinds of places. So now we have the 3 departments, originally transportation and product, and added to that environmental studies. On the first 2, they share a curriculum through the first 4 terms that is the same. At the end of that time, in selecting a major, about the end of the 4th term, if you're going for transportation design, then you would have 8 terms, and I mean 8 classes, which are spread out in that 8 term area that would be specific to that subject, and you would have 6 terms, or 6 sequence classes of product design, and then swap that if you're going the other way. If you're a product designer, you'd have 6 terms of transportation design, 8 terms of product. The reason for the thing is that not only do you need to fill the classes in a business sense, you have to have so many bodies in order to make the space pay for itself, because education is a business unless you're totally sponsored. Very few colleges are. Most of them do run the red. Art Center runs in the black, which is a unique feature of its good management.
Expensive?
Yes, but not. It's in the middle of all of the, how would you qualify this, privately endowed colleges, eliminating the tuition standards that you set in, say, in state universities, that sort of thing. Now, we're right in the middle of that spectrum. We're not the highest, we're not the lowest. USC is considerably higher than we are, for example. And I don't know what University of Michigan is like, but I suspect that we're a little bit, I think we're lower than they are. On the other hand, we're not on the bottom. So currently it's running around $3,000 a term for the student. That's for tuition alone, and then you can double that for materials and living expenses. And to say nothing of transportation, because in our location up on the hill, we really need a car. You can get by without one, but it's tough.
Yes.
And so on.
How did Adams have to come up to Pasadena? What happened to
it? That, I don't know. It really was Los Angeles where we started out. And I think he felt that the cultural and artistic endeavors that were going on in this area were broader in scope than they were in any other city. And he liked the West anyway, being from Phoenix. Or Tucson, pardon me. if you consider the movie industry for one, and then all of the other burgeoning industries, the oil industry, and there's a fair amount of advertising business out here. There's a little of everything, and it's reasonably strong as a commercial base.
Mm-hmm.
So recognizing that, I think he saw that. But probably the vitality of the artistic environment, which includes the movies and all of the things that pertain, that's all the creative endeavors that are visual, and the photography side too. So it looked like a good place, and besides, it's a good, it's a, obviously a popular place for people to live while they're getting their schooling.
Yes.
Yeah. It's the idea of being able to go to the beach on your day off, I think, is an idea that nobody ever forgets. It doesn't happen because everybody's too busy, but they think that it's a possibility.
It's always there.
Sure. Or for your vacation, at least you only get rained on once in a while.
What kind of students has it attracted that it continues to attract?
Because the standards were very high in the first place, it attracted people who were quite serious about it, and they've always had a filter system. That is, any applicant coming to Art Center has to display a portfolio of work previously done to indicate the sincerity of their aptitude.
Yeah. Does it work?
Yes, indeed it does. But obviously, there are always going to be some people that slip through some way that isn't a perfect net, and there may be a few people that will come in because they've had pictures of cars in their portfolio, then, well, that means they're a car person. That's not necessarily true. And besides, it's not fair to simply say, we don't think you look good enough, we'll give you a trial. And so, naturally, there's going to be a percentage, we'll say maybe 30% or more, that are on a uneven base to start with and then can prove themselves. And as a matter of fact, the exposure to the college's environment often brings out talents that are latent in many of these people, and when they manifest themselves, they get into a momentum that won't quit. But you have to give them the chance. Well, in the history of the college, which dates from actually from 1930, more operational maybe in a year or so after that, but we use the 1930 date as the foundation point, it's managed to attract, as we've just mentioned, some very highly qualified people. And now, in recent times, there's a man at the Ford Motor Company, of which we're deeply proud, Jack Telmac, who is in charge of North American design operations and working in close collusion with the vice president of design,
Don Kopka.
That's one. And then throughout the industry, there are a number of people who have achieved eminence, but that's probably the highest in the automotive business so far. One of our best-known graduates, and I think we owe him as much as he certainly owes us, as far as background is concerned, is our friend Sid Mead, who is a unique futurist. That's the definition that most people like to use, but the man is a profound designer and an absolutely brilliant illustrator, and on top of all of that, has achieved a polish in his personal presentation that's just marvelous. He's a constant delight to talk with, is able to take time, even when he's working, to talk with people who are seriously interested. He's a very genuine kind of a person. And we're exceedingly delighted to have that association, have had that association. My own experience, I had him in a transportation design class, and this inevitably comes up. What do you do when you have a genius that comes like that through your class, and you're far inferior to him, even at this stage of the game? Well, what you do is you ask, everybody puts their work up on the wall in the morning, and you have generally a critique. When you get to Sid, you simply ask him, Sid, would you tell us what you're doing here? What was your concept, and so forth? And so he does his own critique. That's the only way you can handle it, because you wouldn't dare say, I think you should have used a little more blue here.
What about Sid Mead? He's probably an example of a really creative, imaginative guy who didn't really feel comfortable in the automobile industry.
No, he went through Art Center as a transportation design major on a Ford scholarship.
What did the administration react to him? He must have stood out.
We were on our knees bowing most of the time. No, we really appreciated him every inch of the way.
Yeah, okay.
And the reason that he draws so well is from the very early beginnings, he just drew a lot of time. It's what we call mileage. When you draw a great deal, you put a great deal of effort into anything, that's piling up the mileage. And I can remember times when Sid was living in a basement apartment while going to school, and this is in the spring, and there's some pretty neat events out there. We used to have a lot of club racing. This is in the heyday of the sports cars.
Mm-hmm.
And middle to late 50s, which is when he was in Art Center. And the SCCA was running an event out of Pomona here for sports cars, and I thought, you know, he'd love to see this. And it took me about an hour to pry him out of his apartment down there. He was pale as a ghost because he never got out in the sun. And he had a bit of a complexion problem because he wasn't really eating properly and so on. So yank him out of there and get him out. Well, you finally get him to the event, and he just had himself a marvelous time. And he would see things that I would miss completely. There was an apex of a corner where the car's coming around, and they would clip the edge of this thing where there's a little bit of dirt and throw up a little cloud of dust, and the following car would pick up a highlight off the windshield, a reflection of the sun that would go through this dust. And it fascinated Sid. I never noticed it. He said, "Look, you see that?" And he would pick up details, and then he has this photographic memory where he can remember. He loves to remember features of the way light works on form, or a reflection pattern, or a dramatic moment. And he draws on that incredible memory to bring his visualizations into a fabulous process.
I had the impression, with a very not any way through him, his work, which I like to enlarge, is that he's gone far beyond the confines of the automobile industry.
Oh, yes. He did when he was working for Ford. Is a funny thing. He made a connection, and I'm not sure just how, with U.S. Steel Corporation. Well, it was through a publishing company, I believe, in an outfit in Chicago. And somewhere or other, he was asked to illustrate a book for U.S. Steel, which would be a giveaway, and agreed to do this, but it would be a conflict of interest.
Oh.
And so he signed those first illustrations for that very first book, not with his full name, just M.E. Well, the moment comes, of course, when the book is published, and naturally the executives at Ford get a hold of several copies, and they see this thing, and they, damn, that looks exactly like me. Sid, come here, man. Did you do these? And of course, what do you do in a moment like this? He simply said no.
was that project for John Reinhardt?
Yeah.
Yeah.
John was involved in this thing, and I'm not sure at the beginning if he was into it, but certainly later,
mm-hmm.
when he became a representative for U.S. Steel.
Yeah.
Well. Then, of course, he breaks loose. Now, he'd worked for, I think, a year and a half, or just short of that, for Ford, and this whole thing with his publishing outfit in Chicago is really moving along there. There's another book to do, and the price is much better. Sid got a reasonable lump for this thing. He lusted after a 300 SL Gullwing coupe. He saw this thing on a used car lot, and it was in good condition, so he got his check from this book outfit. He went down and bought the car. Well, he owned the car at the time that he finally made his decision. He knew what the process was. If you told the company that you were going to leave, you didn't even get to go back to your desk, because you might take drawings out with you or something else like that. They brought your coat and hat to you.
Uh-huh.
So he knew all that was in the case. So he went into Elwood Engel, who had been his boss. More than that. It's a little higher on the supervisory level. There's a whole stack of those things.
Yeah.
Anyway. And announced the fact that he was resigning, and sure enough, he had his hat and coat with him. He went out the door and climbed into his Gullwing, and for which he had been able to pay cash, and didn't feel too badly.
Gullwing
Mercedes.
Yeah.
So he was free and clear. And from that moment on, he worked for that company for a while, and then finally formed Sid Mead Incorporated. Met another man who has, to this day, been instrumental in representing him in business, Peter Schneider. S-C-H-N-E-I-D-E-R. Peter is a very forceful guy, and not always, he can do it in any kind of way. Sometimes it's pleasant, sometimes not. But he has been able to staunchly defend Sid's privacy and give him good backup and demanding fees that are appropriate to his skill, which has been helpful enormously. So they've established Sid Mead Incorporated at that point. Now they have Obligon Incorporated, which you see there, which is related to their printout. The printed material is handled through Obligon.
Okay.
So that's including that...
marvelous.
That's a catalog from a one-man show that he did in Japan. Right. Japanese appreciate him maybe more than we do.
I was looking at the two paperbacks up there.
Yeah. Well, that's Obligon. And, the first version of that, later when we get through this thing, I'll show you the difference between the two, which is not important to this.
So he's...
we're being observed.
Yes. So he was a futurist who was far beyond his time. The world is just really catching up with him.
Elwood saw his talent when he was going through school. Every time Elwood would come out to hire new people at the end of each term, he'd check up on Sid because he could see this was a genius, and he wanted desperately to get him back there. There would be a jewel in Elwood's crown to have him aboard.
Right.
So he persuaded him, made good friends. Sid recalls a moment when he's they're strolling down the hall together and Sid notices a strange watch, it's sort of a heart-shaped thing, pointed down here that Elwood's wearing. He said, "Wow, where'd you get that watch?" And Elwood strips it off here. "You want it?" Well, Elwood was prone to go through dime stores and all kinds of novelty shops just looking for fun things like that, and that's what he'd found. It was a cheap watch, but it was unique. But that was typical. Make friends with this guy, keep him on tow. When Sid got that back there, they never really gave him a chance to design production cars. They kept him so busy doing marvelous, beautiful illustrations for the administration's offices. He'd do about, one every week or two. He'll tell you when you talk to him about this. But it was just one after the other. And he was allowed to do a couple of exhibits, one for a Lincoln Mercury exhibit in the rotunda. He stopped. Probably,
was it more than anybody. Elwood Engel, you think?
He was his sponsor in that sense. I say, you know, you recognize him at Art Center. Are we on or off?
We're on, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I don't want to pin any, you don't want to put any pins in any dolls at this point because it's not worth the trouble for history. But so the trouble with Sid was his talent was so great that it was beyond the normal scope of the average designer who will produce a whole series of possible solutions from which the administration may select a candidate and then explore in three dimensions in clay and make a sequence of presentations and eventually achieve production.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, he was so unique and so adept that they couldn't ignore this treasure and would keep him busy doing the things that they thought he did best, but not so rewarding to him. So he had good reason, really, to resign and go on to better things, which started with this illustration thing, but all those U.S. Steel books that he did, and there's a portfolio that followed that, were so brilliant in their concept. Every feature, you might have said that his early figures might have been a little bit stiff, but that certainly was no consideration, no bother, because the drama in the design, the sense of form, and the innovative, tremendously imaginative backgrounds, these things that he did with structures, and he philosophized as far as society was concerned and how this might develop. You know, the old idea of Victor, who was it? Was it Van der Rohe that visualized tall pedestals of buildings where you'd have a sequence of apartments and a great open space in between? Well, he sort of picked up on that and enhanced it considerably beyond that. But in his mind, as he's developing a design, he would orient a whole philosophy for this future social environment. And maybe even a governmental structure, for that matter, opportunities and technology that might make things possible. And it wasn't the theme that a lot of car designers used. We used to playfully call it some kind of plastic. That was the name for a material that you didn't know what it was going to do. It was partly transparent, and it would go completely over the top of the car, be part of the windshield, and maybe it's a built-in taillight. But it's some kind of plastic. We don't know yet, but they're going to come along with it pretty soon, so we'll just go ahead with it. Do you remember... during World War II, there's a fellow that worked for George Walker, who I got to know somewhere along the line, Kirk Wittke, W-I-T-T-K-E. And he was a neat designer. He did a series for that Walker had a commission from one of the aluminum companies. Was it Alcoa or Reynolds? Maybe neither one of those.
What's the name of the firm?
Well, it was an aluminum company that ran ads in high-quality magazines like Fortune.
Yeah.
And Kirk did these future visualizations of cars, which we now call bubble tops.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's just a whole plastic upper and then the car with the surround bumper down below. This is the car of the future, sort of thing. Well, Sid got away from that. He would give it a lot more foundation. And if you talk to him about this, in any one of these times, he can give you the whole background of what is in this painting, how the people live, how they got there, how much time they have for themselves, what the technological innovations are. And one of the most astounding things is his visualization of a satellite vacation spot, which is usually, in many cases, a big ball that rotates and creates its own gravity and has an axis. And in that context, he's designed a whole sequence of activity patterns that are quite, one of them is a race, which he did for a poster presentation in Japan. That's something that he can go on with and very adeptly. His speech style, mental recall, composition is really quite profound, so I wouldn't want to spoil that.
What could he have done in a orthodox automotive design studio? Where could he have been most effective?
probably as much today as any time, if he had wished to do so. The reason I qualify it that way is because his interest is so profound and so widespread that I would wonder if he would be rewarded sufficiently to indulge in just a controlled visualization program. But in today's approach to the future market, it's not only just the novelty of the thing, but it's the employment and development of certain technologies which will enhance the safety and convenience both of the operation of the vehicle. So you have anti-lock braking, for example, which is one part. You have all types of instrumentation. You have protective materials. The idea now, of course, which is not new, of doing an outside skin in various kinds of plastic would have resilience to them rather than the idea of being permanently dented like metal. So his ability to coordinate all of those things toward a picture, a spectrum, and he does this, incidentally, as one of the things that he employs in his general performance, is to be able to conceive an assembly of all of these technologies and the social environment in which they would exist in the near, middle, far future, whatever it may be, and to enhance it with a great deal of artistic skill. So that total visualization. Now, if he were to have worked in the industry, the place for him would have obviously been to direct and to amplify an advanced concept area. That would be the ideal place for him. But there again, I suspect that the difficulty in making it a practical adventure, as relating those products to what would come off the assembly line, might be too big of a gap, and there would be too much frustration involved, which there is. And it's only in just recent times that the industry is enjoying now, separate, away from advanced concept centers, which we began with Calte. I guess we need to get to that sooner or later.
Yes.
They have found that the intimacy of the hierarchy with the creative staff can be a retardant, can diminish the opportunity a little bit, and there's a great deal of politics that plays its way through there, which is incidental. So the obvious thing is to just take these people away. Well, now that's dangerous, because politically the people who are in power resent the loss of control. They want to be responsible for all of this stuff, and there's somebody away from them that is doing something wildly different. They would savor that themselves, and they'd like to have their finger on it.
How does Sid Mead support himself in 1986?
Through his corporations, which are now double, the Obligon is one and Sid Mead Incorporated being the other. Until recently, as far as I know, he did a lot of architectural illustration for some of the big architectural offices down in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And when they wanted to make a very elaborate and convincing presentation, they would turn to an illustrator like this to portray their product.
Fairly orthodox product.
Well, that's a bread and butter thing as far as he's concerned, and you wouldn't ignore it. On the other hand, it's only a limited opportunity to exercise his imagination, because he's confronted with their structure, and so what he's embellishing it with is some light values and some drama in the foreground and so on, and certainly the elements of color, and for which he demands and gets a very substantial fee. Well, that's an ongoing thing. Well, sooner or later, of course, this book Sentinel, which he'll have to tell you about how that came about. There are two brothers in England, and one of them, a very adventuresome sort of a designer, produced a book on his own works and then was aware of Sid and offered to do the book on Mead, which turned out to be Sentinel. But that went through some changes in the process. By the time it got to the market, the distribution was in a state of flux, going from one outfit to another, and the printer had moved to Holland and set up his own business, and there was a lot of controversy involved there. That book is not dead, by the way. It probably will be reprinted in Japan and called Sentinel 2, and there were plans for that. Okay, that was an overture for him that opened up a lot of new doors, and he knew that it would, because it was like a portfolio display beyond anybody else's, for sure. And so I think the people at Hollywood became aware of his creative visualization technique, his abilities, futurism. And when this recent flood of science fiction movies began to hit the market, why, Sid was invited to participate. He'll have to tell you some interesting stuff about the relationship with the unions at this point, or I should say the guild. As he was outside the guild, not a member. You have to be invited, and you have to apply to be invited. There's something in there that's a little obscure, but anyhow, it's kind of weird.
And
I can't tell you. Something like that. But it has a very tight control on that sort of thing, and if you employ somebody outside the guild, then you have to pay a penalty,
mm-hmm.
which his employers did.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's been through at least two movies doing a prolific amount of work, conceptual work that's been tremendous. The black hole was one. The V'ger concept, for example. The Tron was a thing he contributed to, and that was Desi Studios, and then, of course, more recently, Blade Runner. And I believe there's something else in the works, but that all depends on a deal, so that's...
I thought the Blade Runner sets were very magical.
Well, it was the lighting concept. If you remember, in particular, when you're approaching the great man's office, and it appears to be out on a vast veranda, something with great tall pillars, an enormous sense of space, and the light is coming in horizontally. It's almost like a sunset scene. And this is all Sid Mead's concept, and there's some sort of mystical background there. His paintings depicted this very specifically, and they were able to duplicate the whole spirit of the thing in the sets.
Pardon?
I say they were able to duplicate the whole spirit of his painting in the sets.
Yeah,
Great contribution. And the philosophy, as a matter of fact, of the societal environment, which he was not the only contributor, but he helped to work on this. What will happen to Los Angeles in the future? This wave of Asian investment having a big effect, and then, of course, creeping further into the whole social structure. And so, if you remember, many of the signs were Asian.
Yes.
And there is a great mix of population and this moisture business of raining all the time. These are all things that they thought out rather carefully of what could happen. Yeah. It was so alarming that the city council got very exercised in looking at the future of Los Angeles and saying, we don't want, wait, let's not have that.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Okay.
What, a sidebar, which might develop into a major topic, what about lady or female designers? You've had some experience with some of them. Sue Vanderbilt sends her love and affection after a couple of episodes she described. But before we get to that, what has been your feeling over the years about lady designers?
The whole idea of automobilism has primarily been a masculine one. And there occasionally will come along a girl who has an aptitude that inclines in that direction. Yeah, I'm trying to remember the name of the current designer at GM who has such eminence, and we may have to pause for a minute. We're just talking about Carolyn Peters, and she and her husband, Tom.
Carolyn, all right.
Well, they went through Art Center at the same time and fell in love.
What was his first name?
Tom.
Tom Peters.
Right.
What was her maiden name?
Rotundo.
Oh, okay. Good.
So they got married here in Pasadena, and I was privileged to go to their wedding and observe this very Catholic affair. Right? It was beautiful. And they went away in a Rolls Royce. I mean, it was all done in the best sense. Their romance has stimulated beautiful work on each of their parts. Tom is into fluid forms that are fresh and unique and have totally captivated Chuck Jordan, and so they're the big enterprise. And he's responsible for a lot of the genetic feeling in their two newest show cars, which happen to be the Buick Wildcat, and then following that, the Corvette Indy. And these are very fluid.
Yes.
There's romance in every bit of this thing, and this wild adventure that Tom is going through is, to me, obviously a product of a magnificent romance that they're living, the two of them. And she is as good herself, and the things she's done in the Cadillac Interior Studio, brilliant stuff. Both of them draw magically. Okay, this is all related to what happens to lady designers. Well, in a case like this, they're all unique. I don't. It's pretty hard to categorize people in design, even if they do fall in general groups of enterprise. We had a girl whose name I can't remember at the moment, a black girl who went through not long ago and on a scholarship and was well received and hired by Ford. And if I got out the copy of the Smithsonian, I could tell you.
Yeah, that's good.
All right. Well, the girl's name is Emmeline King.
E-M-E-L-L-I-N-E.
Right. So this only happens once in a while because that sensitivity for automobile design, as I say, is a unique thing. And where the people come from and how they arrive is almost impossible to predict. You would expect that in urban environments that are closely associated with the need for the automobile that you'd find the most of it, or maybe in areas where there's a lot of sporting activity, racing. And certainly Southern California has always been a hotbed for individual automobile attention in any number of ways, from customs all the way through classics into racing and hot rodding and all of those things. But that's not the only drawing card. It's these people come from everywhere. I don't know what Emmeline's background was, but she certainly had a flair for it and did beautifully, and a unique individual, and was well received by Ford, so.
How are they using it, Ford, have kept up?
I don't know.
Well, stereotypically, over the years, as you well know better than I, lady designers, as they've been gradually utilized, I think starting with Harley Earl, one of the earliest, I think, they've been pretty much thought of as color and fabric for people. Recently, they've begun to break out of that mold. What's your view historically as you've seen it this over the years?
Perhaps they have been inhibited by the lack of obvious opportunity. That's what crosses your mind. You think that if they felt there was an opportunity, they might pursue it more, but being discouraged in the outset, they probably take off in another tack. Now, there's no way of knowing exactly, because it depends on how much fortitude and ambition they may have in order whether they decide to pursue it or not. The doors are there. The doors are open, I should say, and in these two colleges in particular, the other college in Detroit and Art Center, there, most people that are interested in that field at all are aware of the two colleges as professional avenues, mm-hmm. avenues to professionalism. And even young ladies that go to school in the East, Rhode Island School of Design, for example, or Pratt Institute, are aware of this opportunity, but I think they regard it as pretty much of a masculine environment, and unless they have a burning desire, they'd just as soon opt for something that's near to it. We have a few more people, a few more ladies that go into product design, but there again, I'd say the vast majority are masculine.
Mm-hmm. It's still a masculine preserve, is it?
Not meant to be, it's just it happens to be that kind of a process that appeals to the masculine mind, I think.
Yeah. Are you bringing ladies, female students forward, not as quota, but as a deliberate attempt to counter this influence?
There have been various encouragements in the past. The government has taken a tack, as you know, in which I've forgotten what the target date was, but there was a suggestion they wanted to achieve 18% of minorities and women by some specific date, and I think the target is just about now, in which case, of course, the door's been made wider. One of the ways at Art Center has been the opportunity of certain scholarships which are only offered to minorities, and in this case, that can be interpreted to be female. Because they are, as you point out, a minority in the profession. And so if the scholarship is available, then it means that the financial pain is lessened.
Yeah.
And that's one way. As far as recruitment is concerned, I don't know, because I haven't talked to our new recruiting people, so I don't know what their posture is on this, other than, of course, the obvious desire to encourage. One of the ways that we do recruiting is to offer a mini course every term, which is done on Saturdays, for high school students, and this is publicized well through the local schools. This goes all the way down to the beach, Newport Beach for that matter, you know, radius of probably, I could even say more than that. Some, we've occasionally had a student that might come as far away as Bakersfield, but for a Saturday, that's a little tricky. Anyway, in this, we have orientation programs for the major departments of the college, and in recent years, we've been doing this for industrial design, in which the students are oriented to all of the areas of industrial design that we handle, including transportation design. And the first day, I usually open this thing and I ask them where do they come from and what brought them here and what's their passion, what are they really interested in. The girls, if they are into that kind of thing, usually say architecture, because high schools have little in their art or drafting classes beyond that.
Yeah.
Now, there's either watercolor painting and some form of advanced art or drafting. And drafting takes on a little bit of basic engineering in that case, and if a girl is inclined that way, she might perhaps pursue it. But I think it all depends on what your friends are doing, what you feel like doing when you're in high school, which is maybe not too much bearing on what your later career is going to be like.
Historically, though, in spite of, let's go behind the stereotype, and behind all stereotypes are a germ or more of truth. The truth was that since the engineering and the burgeoning fabrication end of design was closed, perhaps unjustly to females, they tended to gravitate from fashion backgrounds into the automobile industry. In other words, a Harley Earl or some other visionary would say, look, a lot of ladies drive cars, a lot of ladies buy cars.
Yeah.
And damn it, we've got to have somebody who knows something about color and family.
Well, this is what Sue Vanderbilt has told you for sure, because that's exactly how she got hired.
Right, yeah.
Precisely. And those visualizations are too infrequent. I, at this Calty adventure that I was involved with, which
Caltech, you said?
No, Calty, C-A-L-T-Y. Well, we'll come to that in a moment.
Okay, fine.
That's the Toyota adventure.
Okay.
I was given for a brief time and the responsibility of doing what we called color research.
Yeah.
So in this, I said exactly the same thing. Who am I to know all there is about color? I know what I like about it, but maybe my preferences aren't uniform, and what we ought to get is a balance of opinion. I remember Jurgensen hiring me at Art Center when I disagreed with him. So I didn't look for a disagreement, but I sure found it. I hired a lady, interviewed a couple of candidates, and this one sounded bright and sprightly and alert, and so I asked if he would join me in this thing. Well, she turned out to be a lady activist, and when we went in for her third raise, and I introduced her and so forth, and so the boss said, well, what do you want, meaning how much? And she said, I want to be boss. this is part of the peril of today's market, is you've got to try and find a creative leveling device in there. She was a weaver, and she certainly had a great sense of color, but it was specifically oriented to fashion. And so they found there was a, and I'm branching off here, but they found in her case that there was an opportunity for her to survey the trends in fashion and color in general, present these to the management as a basic background for their general orientation into color preferences and movements.
Right.
Then there's another thing that comes into play, which has to do with the government and its infinite wisdom about pollution. And certain pigments, for example, need to be either eliminated or controlled as far as the painting process is mm-hmm. concerned. There are many ways of doing it, water-based painting for mm-hmm. one, mm-hmm. and another one on red oxides, which make wonderful vermilions, but they're verboten when it comes to the environment. Mm-hmm. So that's an interplay.
That is fascinating. Mm. Well, the classic situation is that you have someone like Earl, whether he believed it or not, and I suspect he must have, and Mitchell succeeding him.
Mm-hmm.
Being prodded by their marketing and their population department, coming out of the state and said, look, we've got to have more female designers because this is the wave of the future in terms of consumerism and in terms of the interior design. So they seem to gravitate toward interiors.
There is a general opinion that there are certain people that should work best in the kitchen and that run a vacuum cleaner well and that have a sense of color and fabric and so on. And this assignment has been made toward the female of the species. It persists. The fact is that although women in family organizations are given credit for making many of the selections and probably do, their sensitivity is not necessarily that much more profound. So their candidacy as professionals in those fields is not necessarily preferential, but has been thought to be so.
Mm-hmm.
The point about the whole thing is that there are men who can make those decisions as well as women, and women could probably make many of the decisions that men do. They certainly tell us that they can. And so I think it's a little bit of a misnomer to assume that this minority has been neglected as far as authority in certain fields are concerned. It's possibly true that there are certain sensitivities and that they are emotionally based, and if you want to get into that, that's another story. But the fact of the matter is that each individual has a different makeup, and it's pretty hard to categorize on sensitivity.
There's a recent trend, however slow, into moving certain key top women designers into out of interiors and fabrics and into actual designing. Now, one of those is Mimi van der Molen from Ford Motor Company, who's
yeah.
working with the Taurus. She came out of, had been working with her. She came out of the interiors.
I understand she's hot, too.
Yeah, very hot, yeah. In fact, this is the piece you're probably referring to.
Okay.
Who's hot, yeah. appeared in the Detroit News. But tying it up with Art Center and recruiting, Suzanne Vanderbilt remembers you fondly and remembers her, well, it was sort of a fond terror. She still remembers that it was a bleak period. She and one of her fellow,
Miguel of Montana.
Jean Reynolds.
Yeah.
who came out at your invitation to talk to the students.
Jurgensen's invitation.
Was it Jurgensen?
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
She said
and Adams.
You were involved. She said,
yeah.
Yeah. And that you brought them out and gave them a lesson, and suddenly said, here you are, and you gave them a room full of students.
Yeah.
I said, go ahead, talk about
do your thing.
Do your thing. She says she still hadn't quite gotten over the terror of that sudden.
Well, she never showed it for certain, because every one of us were enormously impressed with their expertise and the fluidity of their delivery. It was marvelous, and it was an eye-opener. Uh-huh. Adams was the guy responsible for this.
Was he really?
And, yes, when he was back there, he met them and Jurgensen too. Mm-hmm. And they were just fascinated with these two gals who had a great deal to say and knew what they were about.
Mm-hmm.
And their assembly into that professional environment was total. They were definitely a part of it, and certainly of an era. But they were unique. You know, Sue is, one of the things that she does is makes magnificent jewelry. Did you see any of that?
She alluded to it, yes.
Yeah,
yeah, right.
That was one of her hobbies. She's an enormously profound designer, and the fact that she's a lady is all to her advantage. Mm-hmm. Well, it's surprising that she was impressed by the Art Center environment at that time, because I guess it was like throwing a kid in the pool, but... she was surely adept at it and opened the door for lots of us that we needed to see. It was good.
Mm, well, she remembers it with emotion still. But there was this point in the 50s that you would get stories like this. You'd find a local feature of damsels of design. You'd find almost like Harley Earl surrounded by a harem, really. The sense that, that these ladies were bringing a new influence to.
You have to temper it with the need for dramatics by the media. The
sure.
media will reach out and find anything that has quality of imagination to it and present it in a dramatic manner.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a damn good line, because especially recently of the need for recognition of female abilities. Get them out of the kitchen. Well, sure. No, so if you temper it that way, and then come right down to the basic facts, I don't think that there's too much, in this opinion, obstacle in their path. It's really, the obstacle is awareness, or lack of it,
right.
And where opportunities might lie. And gosh, if you're going to spend $3,000 a term and go through 8 terms, and then double that, as I said, so you got $50,000 there easily for an education. That's a big gamble. And if you got all the way through that thing and then found that there might be some insensitivity toward hiring, well, it depends on your talent. You know, the environment has a lot to do with it too, doesn't it? Where the girl grows up and what she's oriented to as a professional opportunity or even artful expression. And if parents have a role in this, and some parents are very wide open, others are quite closed and see the artistic, if you want to call it, field as being very risky.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's probably as much an obstacle as unawareness of opportunities for education itself. And we do the best we can on this, but I kind of think that there's a lot of girls that are growing up in high school these days that are looking for other kinds of technical jobs rather than artistic expression. That whole thing. Pardon me for getting back to the personal side, but I remember my dad's just disenchantment with this business of my drawing cars all the time back there, and I get out and play football and baseball with the guys often enough, but I mean, it wasn't like a total separation. But on the other hand, he wished that I had read more and were more like him. I guess every parent would prefer that.
Of course.
So he was a bit upset, and it didn't break until I finally got started teaching at Art Center, this fluke of an experience with Jurgensen, and said, well, come on board. And then, since my dad had been a professor, he felt that there was some alignment and we could discuss the idea of education a little bit, but he was very profound in his system. He was very definitive and extremely well learned. He read a great deal. His literature of the Bible course was something else.
Man.
Well, that's an interesting thing, because his father, as I mentioned, was a Baptist minister, and so Dad had a little too much of church when he was a kid, and so he didn't become actually an atheist or anything like that, but he was certainly not a member of the local congregation by any means. And the only time I remember him going to any kind of a church is after my mother passed away, and we went to a memorial service for her, and that was about it. So anyhow, the role that parents play in that thing has a lot to do with it, and I think there are a lot of parents these days who, looking at the technical side of life, feel that computer expertise and anything relating to the new technologies would be more advantageous than artful expression. Very hard for parents to be convinced that you can spend that much money on a risky career. Mm-hmm. So I think that's more of an obstacle than being a female.
Well, that's a nice place to end that tape.